This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It is the second week of November, and this week the president still has not acknowledged that he was defeated for re-election. Most nationally elected Republicans also aren't inclined to admit this. There are a few, like Mitt Romney and Susan Collins, who have called Joe Biden the president-elect, but most others are simply saying that the results haven't been certified and the president is legally entitled to pursue his legal options, which is essentially a truism. The federal apparatus also has not begun the transition process. The General Services Administration, ultimately under President Trump's direction, has not recognized Biden as the likely winner in order to commence the transition process with him. Now, Joe Biden, for his part, looks unperturbed. He said the president's failure to concede is an embarrassment, but it's not getting in the way of his transition, which is proceeding, with former Ebola czar Ron Klain named as his incoming chief of staff. Biden says it would be nice to get the intelligence briefings that he's currently being denied, but he also said there's only one president at a time, and right now that's Donald Trump, so getting those briefings isn't essential, as Joe Biden can't act on them yet anyway. The question that's been roiling Biden voters especially is, how serious and important is the president's resistance to the election results? He's making wild and baseless election fraud claims on Twitter, but his lawsuits in the courts don't really seem to be going anywhere. So do we need to worry about the transition process, or is this just a lot of noise? To discuss that, let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Tim Carney, columnist at the Washington Examiner and resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute on the right. And on the left, Christine Emba, columnist at the Washington Post. Hello.
Hi, Josh.
Hey, Josh.
So, Tim, Donald Trump has lost. Why are Republicans going along with the president and not saying so?
Donald Trump's election 4 years ago showed Republicans that they don't actually understand their base. And this made Republicans afraid of their base. The reason that they were actually less likely to cross Trump, despite his being less popular than, say, George W. Bush and less conservative than any previous Republican president in recent history, is because suddenly they became terrified of who are these people who are electing Trump. And if Trump turns on you, well, then suddenly he can make life unpleasant for you. Some of these guys are afraid of losing a primary. Some of these guys want to be the next Trump in the next election cycle. Some of these people care about their fundraising or just don't want to get mobbed on Twitter. So Donald Trump is being crazy about the election result, and Republican senators are largely afraid to incur his wrath and thus trigger his base, which they do not understand because it's not what they thought the Republican Party was when they got into politics 6, 8, 10, 20 years ago.
Christine, how much does this matter? Joe Biden's at least projecting that he doesn't especially care about it.
I think that on a procedural basis, it doesn't necessarily matter that much. Joe Biden knows that he's won the race. Most of the administrators in government also know that Joe Biden won the race. Things are slowly beginning to proceed as normal under the correct assumption that Joe Biden is president-elect and needs to start his transition. The worrying thing about Trump's refusal to concede is not necessarily what it is doing in Washington, D.C., but the specter that it casts over our democracy, over the understanding that we have elections, they are free and fair, and sometimes one person loses and then their time is over. Continuing to state that our election process is rigged, fraudulent, that something mysterious is happening, that citizens can no longer trust our elections, casts a shadow over the idea of America and how our government functions. It continues to spread this already metastasizing idea that nothing is true, nothing is believable, that the system doesn't work, that nothing can be believed in, that perhaps Trump is our only savior. That's dangerous to the whole American idea.
Tim, how much does that matter? I mean, this isn't the first election in which a substantial number of people have believed that the election was stolen. After the 2004 election, you had quite a few Democrats who would talk to you about conspiracies about Diebold voting machines stealing the election in Ohio, even got Senator Barbara Boxer to bring forward an objection to Ohio's electoral votes. It wasn't considered a serious effort to seat President Kerry, but there was at least some buy-in in the Democratic Party to those claims. After 2016, there was this hunt for electoral college strategies to avoid electing Donald Trump. Of course, Donald Trump claimed that the election that he won had been rigged, and that there had been millions of illegal votes that prevented him from actually having a popular vote margin. Republicans will tell you they believe the 1960 election was stolen. This is different in that you have the president of the United States pushing these ideas. You didn't have Richard Nixon running around the country for 4 years trying to delegitimize the Kennedy-Johnson administration because of complaints over that election. Does it matter that these theories are being propagated by the president, maybe, you know, increasing the share of people who buy into them or the confidence with which they buy into them such that there's a bigger problem than there always has been with people distrusting the results of elections?
I think it does, but I think this is another case where Donald Trump doesn't actually represent a change in kind, but sort of a big lurch forward in the direction that we were going. In 2000, it wasn't just that Democrats tried to argue, oh, if you counted every vote in Florida, Gore won. You had members of Congress. I was at congressional hearings in 2000 and 2001 where Democratic members of Congress said this was a coup d'etat. And I remember being shocked at the time. Now, those aren't shocking words today, unfortunately, because, again, every election since then, we've ramped up. In 2004, you had not just this sort of this show on the House floor where every Democrat came forward and say that Bush didn't really win Ohio or we shouldn't count his win. But again, Barbara Boxer gave it legitimacy by being the one senator to go along with that show during the Electoral College count. You had birtherism under Obama. 2012, I think, was the closest thing we had to an election result that people actually accepted. And then in 2016, you had the Electoral College ploy. You had the Washington Post. You had Hillary Clinton saying we shouldn't count this election. And then you had 4 years of this Russia stole the election media saying Russia hacked the election conspiracy theory. And Donald Trump takes it further. And for exactly the reason you say, it's a lot more troublesome. It's not just the cranks in the House and the Senate and the media who are calling it. It's Donald Trump. And he's not just saying what some conservative commentators are saying, oh, let's make sure there wasn't fraud. He is literally saying that the election was stolen from him. So you have the most powerful man in the party in the country making the most extreme, crazy claims. And what I think this does is habituates his voters and to some extent his opponents to buying into these crazy claims. I don't know that we can point to a material, immediate consequence of this, but in the long run, this further erodes the steadily eroding public trust in our system, in our institutions, and just belief that the other side will ever play fair.
Christine, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, I would just push back actually against the idea that in 2016, Hillary Clinton was saying not to believe the election results. I mean, there was evidence that there, you know, were campaigns in our election by foreign actors. But after Hillary Clinton lost the election in 2016, she called Donald Trump to, you know, concede. She stated that she knew she had lost and that the election was now over. It was decided. While there may have been questions and complaints about the way that campaigns played out, the election results were understood to be a real thing. The system was understood to still stand. The transition happened. This is, I think, different, very different in kind, because Donald Trump is refusing to concede the election entirely, refusing to actually state that what happened did happen. It's not even a question of, you know, methods of campaigning. It's that he is saying that the whole system is mistaken, that he actually won, which is just a completely different level of mistruth. And I don't think that it's, you know, fair to say that those two things are equivalent.
Tim, I want to look ahead to the Republican Party's relationship to Donald Trump through this transition period and then afterward, because Donald Trump, in the process of losing this election, got north of 10 million more votes than he got last time. He will be by far the presidential candidate who's gotten the second most votes ever. Of course, not good enough, because Joe Biden will be by far the presidential candidate who got the most votes ever. And so one thing that we've seen, one of the reasons this election was significantly closer than expected, was that Donald Trump did a really good job turning out people who don't usually vote to come out and vote for him even more than he did in 2016. And so I have one of my big surprises in this period, because I was sort of expecting Trump to lose and then the usual thing to happen to losers in political parties, which is that everyone starts to hate them, that you become blamed for losing. And, you know, the party is figuring out what you did wrong and what we can do differently next time so we can win again. And I don't see that process happening at all in the Republican Party. And I don't think it's solely like an irrational Stockholm syndrome thing. I think they see that, you know, there are voters who switched. You have all these suburbs where there are voters who used to vote Republican who are now voting Democratic, but you have all these new voters who got brought in. And Trump is doing something that other Republicans couldn't do to bring them in. And if you lose Trump, then maybe those people don't vote and you've still lost those suburban voters. So the Republican Party, I think a lot of people are looking at this and saying, you know, we still need Donald Trump in order to have hope of winning the next election. And they're not able to move on from him in the way that you normally would. Do you think that's right? And if so, what does that mean that Donald Trump and the Republican Party will try to do together during his post-presidency?
You're right. Donald Trump brought into the, I don't want to say brought into the Republican Party, but got people to vote Republican who didn't vote Republican before. This is why he won Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin 4 years ago. You can look at the sort of county by county maps of how the vote moved, especially from 2012 to now, and you see these very interesting patterns. Yeah, Democrats did better in the suburbs than they did under Romney, but you know, along the Rio Grande Valley, as we talked about last week, in a lot of blue collar places, either formerly industrial or rural places, upstate New York, the Ohio River Valley, including in Ohio. Ohio's now not even a swing state anymore, or wasn't under Trump. Western PA, again, Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota. Trump had the ability to reach out to the working class white voter. That was the Sean Trendy called 8 years ago, the missing white voter showed up. The sort of Paul Ryan, Mitt Romney party doesn't have the appeal to them. So the question is, can you hang on to them? Can you get them to show up? They didn't show up in 2018. This was a huge thing. Republicans, a big part of why they lost the House in 2018 was that Trump succeeded in pushing the suburban voters over to the Democratic Party sort of permanently. But those Trump voters he brought in 2016 and again in 2020, they didn't show up in 2018. So that's a question Republicans are saying. How can we get those Trumpers to become Republicans? They haven't become Republicans yet. And I don't know that Republicans can do it, but they're afraid that if they sort of throw Trump overboard, they have no chance of getting these guys in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, and Ohio to show up again in 2 and 4 years.
Christina, I'm wondering what that means for Democrats going forward, because it's been almost a punchline over the last 4 years how much Republicans wish they could continue to run against Hillary Clinton and to some extent have continued to run against Hillary Clinton. I think that's going to be very tempting and quite possibly very fruitful for Democrats. Donald Trump remains a broadly unpopular figure, even if not quite as unpopular as the polls had suggested. And unlike Hillary, I think Donald Trump is going to be very cooperative in the not going away part of that. That Democrats who relish attacking him, that he will attack right back. He'll be happy to keep his name in the news. And so you have these voters who have been turned off to the Republican Party because of Trump, and maybe that advantages Democrats to keep him in the frame. But then you also have his fans who might just be less interested in politics altogether if he was gone. So how did the Democrats deal with Donald Trump not really going away even after he leaves office?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think there are maybe two parts to it. So first of all, I would disagree with Tim and say that actually Donald Trump did bring people into the Republican Party. He brought in people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, this QAnon woman who was just elected in Georgia. She ran as a Republican. This is now what the Republican Party looks like. People who love Trump and people who are in the mold of Trump with all of the unfortunate things that that implies. So that does mean that the Democrats running against the Republican Party will be running against Trump or the image or after image of Trump and Trump-like figures. Josh, as you say, I think that, you know, will be tempting and kind of great for them because they can just look over and say, this is insane. These people don't know how to govern. They don't believe in America. They are harming our country. That's a pretty easy case to make. It's also a little bit too easy. And that goes to part two. I think that while it will be again, easy to keep harping on the obvious failures of the other party at this moment in time, what voters, what real people are looking for, and frankly, what should be the responsibility of anybody who is running for office or trying to enter the system, is to provide material advantages to citizens and voters. So that should actually mean, you know, legislation and action on things like healthcare, the minimum wage, childcare, et cetera, things that make people's lives better. Moving away from the sort of combative, that guy, he's terrible, I hate him politics, to what can we do to change conditions in America? And that's always harder work. It's harder to make those policies clear. It's harder to be convincing and specific enough. But I think for Democrats to actually be a valuable contributor to American political life, they need to spend more time trying to focus on that aspect, not just railing against the figure of Trump.
Tim, Christine mentions Georgia there. And while this story of how the Republican Party interacts with Donald Trump as a post-president is going to be with us for a while, it's also going to be with us during the transition, as there is this campaign for two Senate seats in Georgia that will determine control of the Senate. If Democrats manage to win both of those runoff elections, you'll have a tied Senate with Kamala Harris breaking the tie votes. What is all of these objections to the election result from the president? What do they mean for that campaign in Georgia? Because it seemed to me that Republicans' key talking point in these runoffs would be elect Republicans so that Joe Biden doesn't have full control of the government and there's a Republican break on what Joe Biden does. But making that argument involves accepting the premise that Joe Biden is going to be the next president of the United States. They also want Donald Trump to come down there and campaign. So you need to keep Donald Trump happy and interested in engaging with the Republican Party. So what does the strategy look like to motivate Republican voters in Georgia? And is it going to be an effective strategy in this sort of weird messaging place?
Well, Josh, I actually noticed an RNC email explaining why Republicans needed to win it. And it said, because if Democrats win both of these races, then Kamala Harris, the vice president, will be casting the tie-breaking vote. So you actually saw reality drip in. But the thing is that Georgia is still slightly a Republican state, and that they rejected Donald Trump because of his unique flaws. Kelly Loeffler, along the lines of what Christine was saying earlier, is a bit of sort of the Trumpified Republican Party, the same kind of divorce from reality and just owning the libs kind of thing. David Perdue is a serious senator, a conservative, and he is exactly the sort of thing that I think can appeal to both the suburban voters, a lot of whom voted for Biden, and the Republican voters there. Can Donald Trump help down in Georgia? I doubt it. I don't think Donald Trump has much ability to help these senators. There is a possibility that if they start, if they earn Trump's wrath, that they could suffer from it. But I think that you will see this is a state that's still slightly majority Republican, and at least David Perdue will far outperform what Donald Trump did in that state.
Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk about what shape the Joe Biden administration is taking. I've been talking with Tim Carney of the Washington Examiner and Christine Emba of the Washington Post. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our Left, Right, and Center, and we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Support for Left, Right, and Center comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switch to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/LRC. That's odoo.com/LRC. Odoo, modern management made simple.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Tim Carney, columnist at the Washington Examiner. On the left is Christine Emba, columnist at the Washington Post. So Joe Biden is proceeding with his transition in as normal a manner as possible, given the abnormal behavior from the incumbent president. Christine, we learned this week that Ron Klain will be the chief of staff in this administration. Ron Klain, formerly the Ebola czar under Barack Obama. I'm wondering what you make of this move, and more broadly, what you can read from what Joe Biden has been doing about what he might do once he becomes president?
So Ron Klain was kind of an expected pick for chief of staff. He's worked with Joe Biden for many years before. He's, you know, well known in Washington and knows Washington well. He's just a trusted campaign advisor. And so it makes sense that he would be brought in for the top job to get things moving as soon as possible. That said, I think the most notable thing about his appointment, right, is that he was the Ebola czar and was very successful in that role. He also, as Joe Biden pointed out in his announcement, was extremely influential in the Recovery Act after the 2008 recession. So it seems clear that at least in his first year, and as it should be, Biden is extremely interested in focusing on the coronavirus. Getting the pandemic under control as much as that can be done, and also trying to prepare America for what an economic recovery might look like or might take, even after the pandemic has left our shores.
Tim, a fair fraction of the coronavirus response aspects of Biden's first 100 days and first year will be things that he can do under his own power as president. But a lot of the economic response, including this ongoing fight about whether there will be another relief bill and what shape it would take, that's going to require cooperation from Congress and most likely cooperation from Republicans in the Senate. What do you see in terms of the likely relationship between Joe Biden and Senate Republicans under Mitch McConnell?
I think that there is an incentive for Republicans to pass coronavirus aid bills. You know, I have advocated a bailout for bars and restaurants. Let's close them all down and give them all the money to pay their rent, their payroll, especially, and other things. And there's not a conservative ideological objection to that in this time of crisis. The question is going to come down to whether there's going to be sort of poison pills stuck in, whether there's Democrats are going to insist on simultaneously some sort of giveaway or keeping schools closed or this or that. And if they're willing to pass a fairly clean bill on the Democratic House side, then you will, I think, see Republicans go along with passing something to keep these businesses afloat. I think in January, you could get bipartisan cooperation if the Democrats are willing to keep it. This is clean money out the door to families that need it and businesses that are being shut down.
Tim, when you say poison pills, local governments are affected by a lot of the same problems that small and large businesses are affected by in terms of the way that COVID has disrupted their usual operations, disrupted their revenue sources. Now, I realize the Democrats were asking for a really large number for state and local government aid, close to $1 trillion. And the revenue numbers for state and local governments haven't looked as bad as it was thought that they might in the spring. So I think there's certainly room to go quite a bit smaller than Democrats have asked for. But is state and local government aid a poison pill in the view of Republicans? Because it's, you know, I understand the disputes over the manner in which school districts have operated, but you have a lot of these essential government services that have been stripped of a lot of revenue, that have had unexpected expenses. And aid like that is needed just like aid to restaurants and other businesses so that they can continue performing their essential services as we get back to normal instead of having to have really big budget cuts.
I didn't fully understand why Mitch McConnell and other Republicans sort of drew the hard line on what they called the blue state bailout last year. But I would hope that with lower price tags, with some Republican governors speaking up, Republican mayors speaking up, that the Republicans would soften from their blue state bailout line last year. That was something that I thought was a little cynical, and I didn't quite understand the politics of it.
Christine, do you see room for reaching an agreement here? And then if you do see that room, is that room before the election? Because the waiting until after January 20th, you know, there will still be value in passing one of these packages that, you know, around the start of February, but our needs could be significantly different by February than they are now.
I do think that there is room for cooperation. I do think that there is room for a bill to be passed before the inauguration, because it's becoming increasingly clear that the coronavirus is getting much worse in America. It is really rampaging. So the pain is only going to continue and in fact become worse. And now that Republicans maybe don't necessarily see their fate as tied to supporting Trump and whatever holdouts and, you know, random statements he has to say, without that incentive in place anymore, I think there might actually be real incentive for everybody to sit down and come to the table and do what needs to be done for actual citizens, not to please a rather insane president who is on his way out.
Tim, Christine raises the elephant in the room there, which is the rapidly worsening COVID situation across most of the country. We continue to set daily records for new diagnosed cases, over 150,000 on November 12th. An issue with tracking cases is that you don't know how many aren't caught with tests. Back in March and April, a huge majority of the people who got COVID weren't getting tested for it. So comparing positive tests by day is not always informative, but we also can see that we're breaching records for COVID hospitalizations, which shows that prevalence really is, once again, as high now nationally as it was in April, as it was in July. Deaths, which are a lagging indicator, those are also rising at an alarming pace, now well over 1,000 a day. And so, Tim, this has implications for the relief bill, including that, you know, part of the Republican argument for why we can have a more targeted bill is the economy's growing faster than we thought it would out of this, and lots of businesses have been able to reopen. This wave is going to interfere with that growth and increase the true amount of need out there in society. But obviously, it also, even more fundamentally, it has huge public health implications. And as I watch this happening and the sort of weirdly blasé reaction that I think we're seeing from lots of people is, you know, I'm not looking for what we did in March and April. I don't think we need a national lockdown. Even places like France that are saying they're going back into lockdown, people in France are still going to work, still going to school. It's a modified version of what they did in the spring. But I look at what we did in the summer, where we had these big spikes in Arizona, across much of the South and the West, and we did intermediate restrictions, and we reclosed bars and restaurants and prohibited large gatherings and did a whole bunch of things and mask mandates. And that, for a time, seemed to go a long way to get that wave under control. And I don't even see that really happening on a similar scale this time. So what is going on? And, you know, it's sooner or later, this is going to be punching us in the face enough that there's going to have to be some sort of reaction.
I think you're going to see in the next couple of days and weeks massive reaction. I mean, different states will react different ways. My governor, Larry Hogan, a Republican in Maryland, has been more serious about it, reacting more sternly than other Republican governors. But I do think you'll also see Ohio and other places have these real reactions. And my hope is, like you say, that they will be moderated. My governor wouldn't allow us to fish on a bank in April. And then he decided, you know what, outdoor spaced out activity is actually good. Focus the restrictions on indoor type activity. So that's what I'm hoping for. I do think you'll see it. And I'm hoping that we've learned a lesson that cracking down on all of everybody's activities is not going to be sustainable.
I would hope that, you know, more governors, whether Republicans or Democrats, will actually begin to say publicly that, yes, we need to start wearing masks. No, we should be very careful about indoor gatherings and large groups, and not politicize it this time around, because we know what's happening. We know that it's everywhere now. And the political benefit of politicizing these things is really no longer there. I'm worried. I think that, as Joe Biden said, actually, we're coming on a dark winter. And I just hope that we're willing to take precautions this time around, at least, to make it less dark than it could be.
One thing that's been completely absent from this conversation the last few weeks has been leadership from President Trump. And now, obviously, I don't think he's provided good leadership at any point through this crisis. But at least in March and April, he was talking about it as a serious problem. Now he's not really talking about it at all. And so, Tim, you know, I understand that ultimately the state and local guidance and rules, those are promulgated by mayors and by county executives and governors. But the president has a role to play here in getting people to take this seriously, especially because so much of the public health response relies on individuals making choices in their own interest and in the public health interest. You know, in New York, we have this rule, you're not supposed to have more than 10 people gather in your home. Ultimately, the state is not really going to raid people's Thanksgiving dinners, but individuals have choices to make about whether it's really wise to gather in small quarters with their large extended families. And it feels like the president, in a normal world, you would want him making some good precautionary comments about what people can do to keep safe so that they can make good choices on their own to support those state and local officials as they make policy decisions. And the president is just showing no interest whatsoever in this resurgence of COVID.
I do think that the biggest difference between Trump's response to COVID and a normal president's response to COVID does have to do with the rhetoric and the tone. I think there's lots of things on testing that could have been done better, but I think the vaccine development has been excellent under the Trump administration. But imagine what a normal president, to use the term Ross Douthat used in his New York Times column, like Jeb Bush would have done. I mean, he would have said to people who were suffering from lockdowns, I feel your pain. This is really hard. Call your friends, call your neighbors. And he would have said, guys, these rules, they're not fun. Let's follow them. Let's keep a distance. When the states started opening up, said, hey, it's still time to be safe. Nobody's going to take away your freedom, but let's do what Americans always do and voluntarily do things. And that would have made a difference. We worried about this when Trump was the nominee, when he was elected, sort of what is the tail risk of a Trump presidency. And this was one where it wasn't just his ability to respond competently to an emergency, but where kind of compassion would have been a virtue. And this is the least compassionate man out of all 340 million people in America.
Tim notes something odd about this week's COVID news. As we look at these grim numbers about increasing case counts and hospitalizations and deaths, we also had extremely good preliminary news from Pfizer about the effectiveness of the vaccine that they've developed, which they believe is over 90% effective in preventing COVID. And that raises the prospect that fairly soon that vaccine will be distributed to large numbers of Americans. This is the light at the end of the tunnel. And so a key question is, how do we get from here to there with the minimum amount of sickness and death? And how long is it going to take us to get there? We're going to talk about that when we come back. I've been talking with Christine Embo of The Washington Post and Tim Carney of The Washington Examiner. This is Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Tim Carney, columnist at The Washington Examiner. On the left is Christine Emba, columnist at The Washington Post. This week brings us simultaneous reasons for despair and hope about the coronavirus. Pfizer announced this week preliminary results from its vaccine trial suggesting the vaccine is more than 90% effective at preventing COVID-19. There are also promising signs about other vaccines that act similarly to the Pfizer vaccine, and we may have broad distribution of a highly effective vaccine by spring. And yet we have to get from here to there as we watch this alarming increase in COVID case counts. So how is that going to work? To talk about that, we're joined now by Caroline Chen. She's a healthcare reporter at ProPublica. Hello, Caroline.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Caroline, this Pfizer news, first of all, is this a done deal? We know this vaccine works, and if so, when are people going to be able to get it?
Yeah, so this is very encouraging news from Pfizer, and I think that based on what we've gotten so far, which is just a press release, I have to note that this is better data, a higher percentage of effectiveness than I think the scientific community was expecting. Now, as I said, we only have a press release so far, so everybody's really eager to see the actual data, and that will be coming out eventually as they submit this to the FDA. And the FDA has promised a public advisory committee meeting where this will be, you know, sort of looked over by a panel of outside experts. And I think at that point, we'll be really interested to see in detail exactly how good the data is and whether there are any safety concerns. So if this all goes well and the FDA authorizes the vaccine, which could happen probably, I would say, in about a month, and then the initial priority group is going to be healthcare workers who are interacting with COVID patients. They're the highest risk. And then high-risk people. So these are elderly folks with underlying conditions. So this is what we're talking about, you know, December, January. And then as Pfizer makes more and more vaccine, they're sort of, think of it as a pyramid, you know, where we slowly move out here. So other essential workers, you know, you think of grocery store workers, maybe other healthcare workers who are not directly in the COVID wards, other elderly folks who maybe don't have pre-existing conditions, and then we move out downwards to younger, healthier folks. And so this is going to slowly spread out as we have more and more vaccine becoming available into next spring and next summer.
And then it's not just Pfizer, right? There's a bunch of other companies that have developed vaccines that are a little bit behind Pfizer in the timeline, do we think that those are, we're going to learn that those also work really well? And if those get approved, does that speed up the vaccination timeline because you have several different companies' vaccines that can be distributed?
Yes. So very close behind Pfizer is Moderna's vaccine, which has a very similar technology. And so people are hoping that because Pfizer's vaccine looks like it has really good data right now, that Moderna's vaccine will also be a vaccine that can come to market. But again, they're not the same vaccine, so we don't know until we know for sure. So then we would have two vaccines on the market, Pfizer's and Moderna's, and then behind them are AstraZeneca's, Merck's, Johnson & Johnson's. Those are all AstraZeneca's and Johnson & Johnson's are in phase three trials, and then a whole slew of others. So, and this is going to be really important because Pfizer alone cannot make enough vaccine for the U.S., let alone the world. And we're going to need all of these different vaccines if we're going to have enough for everyone.
Tim and Christine, I want to get both of you in on this is such hopeful news. And I realize it's not final, but we have a lot more concrete reason to feel good, not just about the prospect of a vaccine, but its effectiveness and its timing than we did a few months ago. And so one of the things we heard a lot in the spring was, you know, we have to, you know, put up with these measures and then, you know, sometimes with unrealistic timelines, you know, 2 weeks to stop the spread, that kind of thing, or the idea that the lockdowns would be for a month or two and then it would be all better. But right now we do really have this ability to look just a few months in the future and say, we're going to be in a much better medical position then if we can just work it out between now and then and stop the uncontrolled spread. And so I watch with a little bit of despair the spread of cases now, because really that argument that wasn't a good argument in the spring is a good argument now. Just put up with this for a few more months, and then these draconian measures will no longer be necessary. And so I'm wondering, you know, what is difficult about getting that message out there? Christine, do you want to take that first?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think we're seeing the results of a phenomenon that's described like in every article, right? Coronavirus fatigue, pandemic fatigue. You're right. It may not have been a good argument in March, but people tried it in March, tried to stop the spread, and then kept trying for months and months. And now everybody is sort of looking at the fall and realizing, oh, this has been a whole year of this. I am tired. I know I should be wearing masks, but I'm just tired of wearing masks. I know I should keep not seeing my family members, but I'm really tired of being alone. And, you know, in the short term, people feel their feelings and their emotions, and they do what they feel pressured to do. Unfortunately, we've waited for so long, and the timeline has been so long that it's becoming far more difficult to defer our pleasures and needs, even if, you know, there is a vaccine in the near future. I'm not sure what we can do about this. I mean, I think it will take some psychological understanding, some really strong messaging from government and others to keep people's spirits up. But I think that the American populace feels really ground down right now. And just news of the vaccine may not be able to change that in time.
Yeah, I think that the light at the end of the tunnel does actually help. And that if we say, you know what, give up Thanksgiving and move it to mid-March. If you could say that, I have a niece who none of her aunts and uncles have seen this new baby. And we're wondering, is this baby going to be walking before we see it? We'll probably, in my family, we'll probably have three or four new nieces and nephews if we're waiting until next year. So I actually have a question for Caroline, and I know it's too specific to really answer, but tell me how we would think through it. I think about mid-March. I'm an Irish guy. I think about St. Patrick's Day. I'm a t-ball coach. I want to have my kindergarten boys and girls out there on the t-ball diamond in February. I know that the parents want to feel safe about it. What are we looking at? What are the odds? What would need to happen? What percentage would need to get vaccinated? What would need to go right for me to have the players out there on March? And I'm frying fish for them on a Friday also.
As you said, I can't really answer this question, but let me give you some parameters that you'd want to think about, right? So whenever people ask me questions like this, I always say there's no one-size-fits-all answer, and so much depends on where you are. And currently, my answer is, well, everywhere in the States is bright red if you look at these maps, which is kind of horrifying, honestly. But oftentimes prior to this terrible moment, there are different states that have been doing differently, right? So a lot of my answers have been like, it depends on what the infection rate is in your state. And I think people often forget that we still have a lot of control right now before there is a vaccine, right? So we can, through social distancing and masking and our own behavior, bring down the infection rate. And so if you were to say, my goal is to be able to do these things by February, and we all said that, we could bring down the infection rate cumulatively, all of us, so that the infection rate drops, so it is much safer for us to, you know, put our kids on the field by February. And, you know, things that you're saying, outdoors, much lower risk. You know, keep your kids' masks on, much lower risk. You know, you're not saying to me, I would like to be by February singing indoors with a choir, right? I would probably say to you, that's not going to happen until everybody's vaccinated. But outdoor sports for kids, things like that, that's a possibility. And then speaking of the vaccine, you know, I just reported with my colleagues that there are a lot of challenges around Pfizer's vaccine specifically because it needs to be ultra cold storage. And that is a huge challenge for a lot of states to get them to remote and rural areas. So, but if Moderna's vaccine gets authorized as well, very close to Pfizer's, for example, it is not as challenging. So let's say both of those vaccines are out on the market by sometime in December, and they are able to be distributed. And I'm saying best case scenario here, right, that the states work out an ability to distribute them, then we might be in good shape by next spring. If conversely, the states don't get their acts together, you live somewhere super rural and hard to get to, and the ultra cold storage requirements turn out to be a huge barrier for where you live, you might be in more trouble than somebody who lives in an urban area where it's much easier to get the vaccine. So these are all factors that are going to affect individuals depending on where they live, the infection rate in their state, and also our own personal behavior, whether we make the pandemic worse or better.
Caroline, one message that we'd been hearing for the past few months from public health officials was that the vaccine was not going to be a silver bullet, or at least we couldn't plan on that, that you would still need certain social distancing measures and certain masking and that sort of things. The vaccine would be one of many tools in the toolkit to stop COVID. But am I correct in thinking that messaging was premised around the idea that a vaccine might be as little as 50% effective in preventing COVID? If these Pfizer numbers bear out, if we have one or more vaccines that are really more than 90% effective, does the vaccine become sort of the single weapon that stops this? Can we go back to society being, you know, precisely as it was pre-COVID once you've widely distributed a vaccine that's more than 90% effective?
So I'll say two things to that. First of all, the 90% number comes from what's called an interim look in the trial. So the trial has not yet reached its final result. So whether or not by the time the trial is officially concluded, the 90% number still holds is yet to be known. Now, given that is 90% at this interim look, it's likely to still be higher at the end than the 50% that we have been talking about. Is it going to be as high as 90% at the very end? Probably going to be a little bit lower than that. But I just want to mention that the 90% number may not be sort of the final number. The other thing that actually is far more important than this is the question of how many people get the vaccine. So if you have a 90% effective vaccine, but only 30% of the population wants to get it because people are vaccine hesitant or because we do a terrible job at rolling out the vaccine and delivering it to people, then we're not going to achieve great herd immunity through the vaccine. And people are still going to have to continue to social distance and wear masks so they don't get sick. So a lot of this is going to be contingent on administering. A vaccine is only good if people get it.
And then finally, you mentioned earlier that there's a question of if states get their act together in terms of distributing the vaccine. What should people be looking for? What should they be asking for from their governors, their mayors, their county executives, their state public health officials? What does it look like for a state to do a good job getting ready to get this thing out as effectively as possible?
Yeah, so what we did at ProPublica is we put out public records requests to every single state and ask them for their plans, because every state had to send a plan for distribution to the CDC. So we've linked to a lot of these plans on our story that we published, and I'm hoping that we're going to make them all available. A lot of states have now started to put these publicly on their website, so you can check your state's health department. I would encourage you to read them and see how detailed they are. Some of them are very detailed. Some of them really are not very detailed at all. And I'm kind of just like, we're just going to leave it up to the counties to figure them out at all. So if your state does not have a detailed plan, I would urge you to push your officials to fill in their plans and answer questions, particularly if you live in a more remote area and it doesn't seem like there is a plan to get the vaccine out. So answer the questions for how are we going to get this to everyone? How are we going to ensure particularly equitable access to the vaccine? Because traditionally we know from the past that vaccines don't reach minority groups, native communities, and people in rural and remote areas as well as they do people. So we know that these are communities that have been particularly impacted by COVID. So this is going to be really important.
Caroline Chen is a healthcare reporter at ProPublica. Caroline, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Christine Emba, it's your soapbox.
So reporting has just emerged that more than 130 Secret Service officers are either infected with coronavirus or quarantining after Trump's campaign touring and the many super spreader events he's held at the White House. That's roughly 10% of the core team of the Secret Service agency. Meanwhile, the president himself has forgotten about coronavirus and seems to have given up on governing at all. Well, now we see very clearly what Trump has always been about, himself. He never cared about the victims of the pandemic, and he definitely doesn't now. In some ways, I actually kind of wonder if it isn't better that he isn't checked out, just so, you know, he's not still spewing nonsense about, you know, refusing to wear masks, injecting yourself with bleach, and freeing, liberating Michigan and Virginia. But I'm still furious at Republicans who continue to defend him and coddle him through his childish tantrums even today, even though we know he's lost the election. Just look at this. Look at what he's done. Are you kidding me? How can you keep putting up with this man?
Tim Carney, what's on your mind?
Students in Philadelphia's public schools haven't set foot in a classroom in 8 months. Some of them were scheduled to return to the classroom right after Thanksgiving, but this past week, the city canceled that plan, citing rising coronavirus cases. Schooling in Philadelphia will remain 100% remote for the foreseeable future. This might be the right call. And though I want to talk about this on a national issue, because I expect many schools currently open will not return after Thanksgiving, and others are going to make a call like that after Christmas. But my rant is not about this decision to shut down the schools now going into the winter. It was a decision in the summer made by Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., and surrounding suburbs, San Francisco, many other localities. They made the decision to postpone opening schools until, well, flu season. This was a colossal mistake by school districts. It wasn't grounded in science, and it will prove to be a massive blown opportunity that will result in lost education, lost formation, lost friendships that can never be regained. This fall, Philadelphia, D.C., our suburbs in Maryland and Virginia, places like San Francisco, had incredibly low spread, incredibly low positivity, talking about around 3% and lower. And where students were in school, what were they doing? They were forming a bond with their teachers. They were forming a bond with their classmates. I talked to teachers forced to teach remotely back in the spring. They said they were constantly calling on that old bond from the classroom earlier in the year in order to try to bring the students' attention back to these dreadful Zoom classes. Those schools that didn't open, Philadelphia, San Francisco, Washington, D.C., and surrounding suburbs, they never gained that connection. The schooling will suffer throughout the year. The places that did meet in person, when they go remote, they'll at least have the memories to call back on, and those students will benefit in a way that so many other students, unfortunately, will not be able to.
For my rant, several times during his term, Donald Trump has tried to name silly people to the Federal Reserve Board. He tried to make Herman Cain a Fed governor. He tried to make Steve Moore, America's worst economic commentator, a Fed governor. And he tried to name Judy Shelton, an economist known for her extreme hard money gold standard views. He tried to make her a Fed governor. This is one area where the Republican-controlled Senate has stood up to Trump, blocking his bad picks. Until now. After the election, Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski announced that she will support Shelton's nomination to the Fed, and Mitch McConnell, now believing he has enough votes to confirm her, has filed to set up that vote. My question is why? What was the point of blocking Shelton until now if you're just going to confirm her after Trump loses? Now, one theory out there is, what's the harm? If Trump had been reelected, people thought he was trying to set up Shelton to be the next chair of the Federal Reserve, where she could have done a lot of damage to the economy. But now that Trump is going to be on his way out, she'll just be another member of the board. We're probably going to see Jay Powell renominated by President Biden. And so if she's there, you know, pushing cranky hard money views, does it really matter that much? And maybe it doesn't matter that much, although the Fed has been the one part of the federal government that has unambiguously worked really well during the coronavirus response, in part because of the unprecedented steps it's been able and willing to take. And with Shelton pushing back against the things the Fed needs to do to support the economy as we continue this recovery, that will be a negative effect. The Senate ought not to confirm her, and it is genuinely puzzling that they were willing to stand up to Donald Trump on this issue for so long at some political cost, and now that he's on his way out, now is when they fold. I just find it completely bizarre. That is all we have time for today, although I want to give you a programming note. So I'm going to be taking some time off, and barring unforeseen events, it's 2020, so don't rule out unforeseen events, my next show with you is going to be on December 18th. Kelly Goff will sit in for me the next 4 weeks. You're going to be in great hands with her, as you always are when she guest hosts, and then I'll be back in about a month to pick up as we prepare for an inauguration. That is all we have time for today. I want to thank Christine Emba, Tim Carney, and Caroline Chen. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Our production fellow is Victoria Alejandro. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.